This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I have the great pleasure of talking to Colin Calloway. He's the author of The Victory with No Name, The Native American Defeat of the First American Army. How are you, Colin?
I'm very well. It's a pleasure to talk with you, David.
Well, you as well. And before we just before we talk about this book, you know, maybe you could talk a little bit about your background, because I know you're British. So as you said in one of your earlier books, One Vast Winter Count, which was about the American Indians or Native Americans in the West prior to American settlement, I think you said, you're really only a Westerner as of West Yorkshire, which I thought was great. But maybe you could talk a little bit about how you came to being a historian, which you are, of the American West or the American experience.
Yeah, well, growing up, as you say, in the north of England, it did seem strange to many people, not only my, not least my parents, and particularly an interest in Native American history. But I think, as I have thought about it over the years, I think that growing up as a European, I suppose, the thing that most interested me about America was the presence of Indian peoples, and the thing that most bemused me as a historian was the relative, and in some cases, complete absence of Indian people from American history books. And so I think if, as I consider my larger body of work, as it were, if there's a consistent theme to it, it's writing about American history with Indians in it, which doesn't sound like much, but it, I think, speaks to that issue that a lot of things that we take for granted in America don't make sense without Indian presence. A lot of things wouldn't have happened the way that they did without Indians. And so I think that American Indian history shouldn't be some kind of just side note or subfield in American history. I think it's central to that story. And so with that kind of broad canvas in mind, I've got endless topics for books about books on Native American history, because it's a way of providing what for most readers might be an unfamiliar telling of a familiar story.
Yeah, or even looked at as the landscape, that it's the story beneath the evident landscape.
Well, absolutely. I mean, to put it bluntly, this is a nation built on Indian land. And with that fact in mind, then lots of other things kind of fall into place, I think.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this book, because, and then we can talk about, I have some other things that I definitely want to talk to you about, but this is a period that, I mean, speaking of American history, I think it is a period that it's safe to say a minority of Americans are really familiar with, and that is the period immediately after the Articles of Confederation and the, you know, an amazing period, in fact, when America was really still quite fluid. And the likelihood of it being a country that would actually survive and last and become a real nation was at risk. It was not clear. And the relationship between the American states then and the Native Americans, plus the Spanish who were still present and the British who were still present and had not given all of the... Given the forts to America that they said that they would do, so that you, as you describe it, America felt at that point hemmed in, but it was also full of uncertainty, as not even all of the states that we think of as early states were then states. Vermont, Maine, others had not even joined the Union yet.
Yeah, I think you give a very good overview of the situation, and I think for us today, for Americans today, because we know what what has happened, and here we have this most powerful nation on earth and everything. It's very difficult to look back to that time and to realize how precarious it all was. And I think people looking at a map of North America, the North American landscape in the 1780s and early 1790s, would not have necessarily imagined or predicted that it would become the United States. The United States, or the not-so-United States, were constituted just really one player in this competition for North America. As you say, there was Spain, there was Britain, there was the United States, and there were multiple Indian nations whose homeland most of America was, and they were not about to simply hand it over. They had their own foreign policies, and they were still, after generations of cultural assault, devastation by smallpox, escalating conflict, etc., they were still formidable powers that shaped American development, but also limited and often frustrated American development, just as they had and continued to frustrate imperial ambitions on this continent. Because we have the longer view of what happened and the treatment of Native Americans in this country, it's easy to assume that the United States was established and then just swept them aside. And that was not what happened. And the founding fathers, people like George Washington and his Secretary of War, Henry Knox, were well aware that Indian nations constituted a formidable presence, and they had to concoct and conduct foreign policies to deal with Indian nations and diplomacies to deal with Indian nations at the same time as they were doing the same thing with European nations.
Although the big difference, and I thought of this even as you discussed the political arrangements of the tribes at that time. I think many of us are aware of the Iroquois Confederacy, but I think the degree to which the Indian tribes allied themselves at various times along the borders with the states at that time, was probably less well known. And I thought you did a really good job of explaining how that was working. But at the same time, the Americans didn't have a fully formed army at that point. And while they were, as you said, they had to do diplomacy with European powers, the Indians were right here. And they were more of an immediate concern. I mean, maybe the British to a certain extent, it wasn't absolutely clear that the British would not reinvade or reassert control. Wasn't certainly clear that how we would interact with the Spanish at that point. But I think with the Indians, this is something else you talked about that I don't think is all that well known, or certainly not well known to me. And that was to think about how the Americans had to finance the country. It was principally going to be through land sale. And that meant, when you sort of think about how Manifest Destiny came about, and it's, an idea that was really developed later in the 19th century, but at the earlier time, it was more of a manifest necessity than a destiny that the country had to take that land one way or the other. It feels like from reading your book that the inevitability was we need that land to raise money to pay the debts of the states and to pay for an army and protection of the country.
Yeah. One of the things that, of course, during the Revolution, the Continental Congress had struggled financially and had resorted to, as had many of the states, offering land bounties to soldiers to get them to sign up. And of course, that meant that was kind of betting on a future that would involve defeating the British and the British handing over to the United States its claims to lands in the West, lands in the Appalachians. At the end of the Revolution, the British did that, recognized American independence, ceded to the United States everything east of Mississippi, south of the Great Lakes, north of Florida. But of course, that was continuing a European or a Western nation's tendency to shift territory back and forth like it was a board game. And Indian people who were living there had something to say about it. But the United States in 1783 had its independence, but it was broke. It had no money. And it had to set about trying to construct a nation which not only involved getting people from the very different states and regions to think of themselves as a nation, which many of them were still reluctant to do, but also to create the infrastructure of a government, not only an army, but a post office and everything else. And that required money, and that required raising revenue. And really what the United States had was land. But you had to take that land, which was somebody else's homeland, and convert it into American real estate to realize that income. And the government, again, I think our popular vision of the past was pioneer families moving out and carving out new lands for themselves right. in the West.
That is the romantic view, isn't it?
But what the government wanted and really needed was a much more controlled process, particularly, and this was the vision of Washington and others in the area beyond the Ohio River, in which the land would be surveyed, divided up, settled, and it would be carried out in an orderly and responsible way by the proper kind of people who were usually, and in this instance, in particular members of one, but members of land companies. And then they would take care of the business of selling or renting land to settlers. That's how it was all kind of supposed to work. It didn't always, but the land was central to it. And as you say, this was not just an option. This was the necessity. And during the Revolution, I think George Washington and others had recognized that would be the case. There was no certainty, for instance, that when Britain did recognize American independence, did agree to a treaty, they would hand all that land west of the Appalachians. What if Britain had said, we'll keep that land, and that the United States would have consisted of the 13 states hemmed in east of the Appalachians? That would have been a very different scenario. And it was certainly one that was on the cards. And one could argue that some of Washington's Western campaigns and some of other people's Western campaigns, like George Rogers Clark in the Northwest in the Illinois country, were designed to stake a claim to those Western lands with an impending peace treaty, peace settlement in mind. It was crucially important.
Yeah. Well, it, there's so many different elements of this early stage of American history that are interesting, but you had focused in this book on what preceded then, and it is amazing for us still to think of Ohio as a frontier. You know, I still somehow, I think that's hard for most of us to imagine, and, you know, the difficulty of travel and the length of time that it took to get there. But so the Americans decided to negotiate. Whether it was in good faith or bad faith, you know, that's actually not totally clear, but it does seem that they felt that, they would make the effort on some level to negotiate with the tribes. I think there was a lot of tension, obviously, between the settlers the land people. And of course, you, as you point out, that the, you know, to a certain extent, the land business was corrupt at its root, or potentially corrupt, because a lot of these land companies were, just like America was doing, buying on credit. I mean, they bought the land at a really low price, but in order to pay for it, they had to sell it. And so, you know, you have this kind of base American form of commerce, which is essentially shilling property you don't even properly own yet. So there was a lot of pressure on the land companies themselves to get this issue settled. And that's sort of behind the whole, what ultimately became a military campaign, because the Americans and the Indians were not going to agree. The Indians wanted the Americans to stop and, you know, recognize a boundary line, which the, you know, the Americans weren't going to do.
One of the things that I think is it's fascinating looking back to that time is that already you see there, or I see there, that combination, collaboration between private interests and national interests. So that the land companies and these, and some of these people have, whose values are seem a little sketchy, are in many ways doing the work of national expansion. The Northwest Ordinance, which Congress passed in 1787, to really kind of divide up that whole area beyond the Ohio River, sets up the American territorial system. And I think it's a, I often think it's a brilliant solution to a problem. What happens if American settlers moving west develop their own societies that mature, grow up, become stronger, and feel we don't need to be governed from Philadelphia or Washington? What's to stop history repeating itself? And just as the revolutionaries had said, we have matured and we're no longer dependent on the mother country, England, so we're going to break off and create our own nations. What was to stop people who went and created new societies in what became Minnesota or Wisconsin from doing the same thing? And the Northwest Ordinance not only sets out formulas for dividing up and surveying land, but also it provides a solution to that dilemma or to that problem by saying that once territories acquire a certain population, they can and will join the United States as equal members with the other states. So it really sets in motion not only the mechanisms for acquiring, surveying, measuring Indian land, but also using or commits the nation to expansion into Indian land. That same ordinance also that says that we will deal honorably and fairly with Indian people. So that a conflict right there, and it's the inherent conflict in American Indian policy almost from the first start. It's predicated on the certainty that the United States must and will acquire Indian land. But at the same time, there is a declaration and an intent, perhaps a hope, that we can deal fairly and honorably with Indian people. Those two things are, of course, in conflict, which points back to your comment about making treaties.
Right? Yeah,
the most honorable and the fairest way to get land from Indians is to pay them a fair price and make an open and honest treaty with them. The problem arises if the Indians say thanks, but no thanks.
That's right.
Because then, what do you, then what do you do?
Right. And that's sort of,
and we know what happened.
Right. That tension is really visible in the story that you tell. It's visible for, 200 years of the recent American history. And that is what, is now would be looked at as broken treaties or ignored treaties, because mm-hmm. so often what the treaty said would happen only lasted until the next wave of settlers, the population requirements, or, natural resource discovery, the famous ones, of course, farther west than Ohio. But I think it's a repeated story over and over again, which, of course, is still with us today. And that's, partly, I was really struck. I don't want to go off the topic completely, but I noticed in reading a review of this book when it first came out in hardcover, there was a review in the Wall Street Journal, and I thought it was a really good review. And then I read the comments in the journal online, and I was struck by the arguments between readers, and probably they hadn't read the book, but who had read the review, and they were arguing over issues, these precise issues, that there are people who were saying, well, the Indians were disorganized and they were allying themselves with white settlers all throughout our history, going back to the early 1600s, as if somehow that was an excuse, that they were not real organized cultures, that somehow there's a willingness to delegitimize Native people as actors, as responsible. I mean, starting way back, of course, when they were, I even noticed in your book, you quoted George Washington praising the Indians for their Confederacy, by saying they were ignorant savages who were, how could we not organize America into a country when these ignorant savages are capable of doing it? And I thought, that is the most obvious problem, in a way, that there is this failure to recognize the tribes as state-like actors, and to dismiss them because they were, in many cases, many of them were hunter-gatherers, many of them were, as you describe them, fluid societies that created alliances based on momentary relationships through kinship rather than politics. So they don't look like a traditional Western political entity, a polity. They look different, and so they were dismissed. And that's still true.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, of course, Native American societies were organized and orderly, but they were organized and orderly in their own ways, and not always in ways that Europeans and Americans could recognize. And one of the things that they not only recognized, but I think made a great deal of, was the fact that Indian people had relationships with the land, but those relationships did not include owning land as property. And for people like George Washington, of course, property owning was going to be the hallmark of, if you like, American civilization. So again, the differences between the Native American and American societies come to almost pivot around and focus on land again, because that's an area of such difference. Homelands, which are occupied and which in some ways own the people who live there generation and after generation, or land which will be divided up, bought and sold like a commodity, and transformed into property, which is a mark of wealth and status and something of capital value. And so I think that the contest over land actually contains all of those other differences and conflicts and worldviews that you're alluding to.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that that is the crux of the difference and of the, and as it is played out today, I am thinking a lot about the Dakota Access Pipeline, mm-hmm. and what it's exposing and the radical difference in worldview that I think, you know, and I think for many years, a lot of Americans have felt that a change in our approach to nature and land could be beneficial. And it's not romantic. It's not a sort of sentimental attachment to, another worldview that is different than our own, even though, we can look at, we look at those two things differently, but it's not sentimental, as some people have made it out to be.
And the 1790s, of course, were not the last time that taking Indian land was justified in the national interest. We have to do this.
No, that's true. It was, in fact, what I think is interesting about the story that you tell is how pivotal it is, because it's like it just broke the dam. There were later conflicts, but by the time, as you described it at the end of the book, that Ohio Territory went from a few thousand settlers to 500,000 in a very short period of time. And, you can see then that the pressure mounts radically over between the Americans and the Indians, where the Indians are simply going to be outnumbered to such an extent that it's impossible for them to stop the flood.
And I think that flood, which of course is a part of American history that we're all familiar with that, we know how that happened. That flood and that the story of that later time obscures our vision and certainly our understanding of that earlier time. That there was a time in the history of the United States when Native Americans destroyed the American army, not an American army.
Right, the American army. No, it's a very powerful story.
I mean, could you think of the furor if a president today lost an army, but George Washington lost the army? He sent the army out, and it was destroyed. Now, of course, it wasn't much of an army by the standards that we measure these things. I suppose it wasn't much of a battle by the standards of huge battles in history. It was no Agincourt, Waterloo, or Battle of the Somme. But in the context of the time, and given the resources of the different nations involved, it was huge. And when the news of that Indian victory and that American disaster reached Philadelphia, Jefferson said people are talking about nothing else, because this was a real jolt to a young nation that was barely off its knees after the Revolution.
That is true. And in fact, I think that it prompted, as you point out, that the establishment of a more properly organized army was necessary. You know, that they had tried to fight this war with a kind of patchwork of militia and a few regular mm-hmm. soldiers. And I think it exposed the need for the country. And I think there was that distrust in the American psyche early on toward having a standing army, toward there being a professional military. But I think that it's likely that this initial disaster helped push the American government into a position which it would never, might not have ever gone to otherwise.
Yeah, I think George Washington believed that to be an effective nation, you had to have a national army. And I think the destruction, the Indian defeat of Arthur St. Clair's army in 1791 demonstrated that. So that now the need was there, but it was also now much more evident. And as a result of that, as a result of this Indian victory, I think the national government is able to push its role in American expansion. That American expansion is something that the government, the state, takes a major role in, and the army takes a national role in. It's not just something that you're going to let leave to settlers and local militia. And even before that that defeat had happened, settlers on the frontier had been lobbying and complaining to the government that you're not doing enough to protect us, that you're safe back there in the east, and our government should be doing more to protect us and should be doing more to take Indian land. But that was an important dimension of that defeat. It was a defeat that had a number of repercussions that we've kind of forgotten.
Well, it's a really good example, I think, too, of how telling a kind of a single small incident can lead you into so many larger topics of discussion. You know, that history digging down into a very what is ultimately a fairly small moment. I mean, it was a big moment at that time, but in our American history, it's been occluded by other events. So I think it's a wonderful entry point into what I think, you know, I love the history of the kind of Northwest when Ohio was the Northwest. It's so unusual and fraught. But so what you had mentioned to me earlier that you're writing another book now. What is your current project?
Yes, and I think the victory with no name, looking at the war in the Ohio Territory in the 1790s, perhaps acted as a stepping stone into this. I'm writing a much larger book, and it's called The Indian World of George Washington. And the philosophy, if that's not too strong a word behind it, is that what I'm looking at is how Native America, Indian people and Indian lands shaped the life of the man who shaped the nation. And in a sense, that's it's doing with an American icon perhaps what I've been trying to do all along, and that is to demonstrate the important role of Indian people in the story, whatever story that is, whether it's the story of the United States or, in this case, the story of the first president. And, of course, for some people, George Washington is the story of the United States. And so if I can effectively demonstrate that Indians are essential, and that there's a Native American thread, if you like, running through the story of Washington's life, I think it goes a long way to reminding us that Indian people were not only present but also very important in the early history of the nation. And I'm not making this up. There's lots. George Washington talks a lot about Indian people in his writings and in his correspondence. Biographers of George Washington haven't done so much. And my book is not a biography, but it does follow a kind of biographical format, showing how Indian people at important moments intersected with Washington's life, and also how important Indian lands were to the nation that Washington was creating.
Well, I will definitely be interested in reading that book as well. I want to thank you for talking to me about The Victory with No Name. Thank you, Colin Calloway. And if anyone who is listening wants to extend your reading in Mr. Calloway's work, I really recommend his earlier book called One Vast Winter Count, which is just an extraordinary piece of work. I really like it.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. I've been talking to Colin Calloway about The Victory with No Name.